podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, a smorgasbord for you today, because there's a lot of cricket going on and lots of things have happened. Obviously, the IPL is underway, though it's under a bit of a cloud, I suppose, at the moment, with the terrible COVID situation in India causing the government and various authorities to wonder about whether the IPL should continue or not. So we'll discuss that a little bit. Fascinating in the county championship with Gloucestershire, your Gloucestershire, Simon, still doing pretty well. They're not three out of three, but they managed to stave off defeat against Hampshire, held out for a draw. So they're still doing really well in the championship. And we're going to talk a fair bit about fast bowling as well, because fast bowlers have done quite well in the early stages of the championship. And we've got a little bit of a clip of Mark Wood talking about how to get faster, and also a famous ex-fast bowler, Jonathan Agnew, talking about his life and bowling and getting Viv Richards out, and also how he got into the broadcasting world as a result of finishing his life as a fast bowler. But first, we should just credit your daughter, Simon, because she's had quite a big influence on the world of cricket, you could say, this week, hasn't she?
Well, I think that's a bit of a big claim, Yoz. But we did mention last week, we were talking about outs, weren't we, in the 100. And I asked her the question, what did she think about that? Did she think outs was a good thing, or did she think wickets was a good thing? And she said, no, it's got to be wickets. It's got to, and she's 13 years of age. It's got to be wickets. She said, that's just a more interesting term. It makes me think, what's that all about? Whereas outs, no, it's a really boring term. And this week we had the news that it will no longer be outs in the 100. I say no longer. It never was, but they were thinking of doing it. So outs are out and wickets are back in. And all those, I mean, there were quite a few people, to be fair, who commented on this, and not least Geoffrey Boycott as well, who had his say. So we had, you know, we had the 80-year-old Geoffrey Boycott and the 13-year-old young man who gave their input. And the ECB have relented. It will be wickets.
It will. And so it makes the podcast that we broadcast last week, which I titled Get Out of Here, quite appropriate, really, because outs have been outed. Which is a good thing, generally, because I felt overall, if you're tinkering with the essentials of the game to that extent, it rather undermines your product. It means you're not totally confident of your product, really, by those kind of fiddles. So maybe it will just be better for the credibility of the 100 in the end.
Well, except they are, you know, they've got rid of overs, haven't they? We're going to have 10 ball overs and they're all going to be from one end. I mean, they have fiddled quite a lot, but outs was just a step too far. It's funny, actually, I was watching the IPL coverage, and we'll come on to the IPL in just a moment. I was watching the IPL coverage the other day and I noticed when they had a sort of head-to-head battle, I think it was one particular player against leg spin, and it had, rather than dismissals, it had outs. They actually wrote the word outs in, you know, number of outs against leg spin in IPL history or whatever for this particular player. So I noticed the term had cropped up in the IPL, but of course, it, you know, overall, it's still referred to wickets. But I did see it there, that term. Anyway, what about the IPL? Players are leaving. Zampa's gone, Ty has gone, Kane Richardson has gone, Ravi Chandranashwin has gone, Liam Livingstone has gone. I noticed in the case of Richardson and Ty and Zampa, also three Australians, they haven't been playing very much. You know, whether that is a factor as well and making it easier decision to go. Livingstone the same. But Ravi Chandranashwin, of course, is a vital member of the Delhi Capitals team. He's played all his team's games so far. But it's your understanding, Yoz, and I know you've been in contact with Manoj Vidali at the Rajasthan Royals. You had a good contact there with Manoj. You know, it is going to continue, and there's no doubt about that, despite the sort of overwhelming situation of COVID in India at the moment.
Yes, actually, I talked to Manoj briefly, and he sent me a text saying that the postponement or the suspension of the IPL is a definite possibility, but the government are focused on keeping it, as it has such a positive impact on mental health when everyone is locked down. So that's one thing. The IPL, the BCCI, have announced today that for the moment the IPL is continuing. And actually, I think not only is it just a valuable thing for people to be able to sort of almost escape from the calamity that's going on in India by, you know, enjoying a bit of cricket in the evening, but also, actually, and probably more importantly, it's such a big, it has such big audiences that it's an opportunity there to get the message across, to stay at home, to wear your mask, to get vaccinated, with a lot of confusion around, you know, the efficacy of vaccinations and the side effects they might have, and some sort of religious elements as well. There have been religious festivals in India which have been permitted by the government, and that's just caused a massive waves of infection. So I think using the IPL as a broadcasting tool to reach out to all the communities, to millions, probably hundreds of millions of people in India, to have prominent individuals, the likes of Kohli and Dhoni and, you know, the commentators and so on, you know, passing the really important messages across, is another way the IPL could use its power. Plus also, you know, continuing to use some of the money that they get through it, through the, you know, the profit that they get, to put into various causes which can help communities. I mean, Rajasthan Royals, for instance, have their own COVID appeal, which they channel a lot of money into in the Rajasthan area. So I think it has lots of assets, the IPL, which can be used in this very, you know, obviously difficult and tragic situation in many cases. Ravi Chandran Ashwin has gone home to be with his family because I think some of them have been infected by COVID. So he has a very personal reason for leaving the tournament. But I think he also says he's going to come back when he can, and perhaps when the situation has eased a bit. So it sounds as if they're trying to be pragmatic. And although, you know, the IPL is a sort of, can be seen as a rather gratuitous money-making machine, as long as they use it in the right way, it can also be very effective at helping the lack of transmission of COVID, I would say.
Mm. And one of the things that Manoj said before the tournament started, you said to him, well, what contingencies does the IPL have if players become infected inside the bubble? And he said, basically, no contingency at all. There's, you know, there's nothing in a sense. You know, how can we plan for that? And we've seen the Pakistan Super League suspended. So I mean, if COVID does get inside the IPL bubble, there must be a chance of the IPL being suspended for that reason as well. And I mean, it's an awful situation in India. We saw the pictures on the BBC News last night. I mean, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? What is going on there? You're right. It does seem, there is that feeling of, it does seem a bit frivolous playing something like the IPL while that is going on. But then, you know, there is that other side of it that you've just outlined. There's been some very one-sided matches so far, but also some dramatic cricket. We had that super over yesterday, and Ravi Jadeja hitting 37 in an over. I expect you've been hit for 37 in an over in your time, Yoz, but it doesn't happen very often, does it? Some people say, well, how can I get 37 in an over? Because I thought 36 was the most you can get, but of course he did hit a no ball for six as well. And I've mentioned this a few times, I saw James Fuller hit for 38 in an over down at Hove, playing for Gloucestershire against Sussex. It was Scott Styris on that occasion who hit him for 38 in an over. 37 in an over. I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it, really? I mean, it's amazing. It was, you know, sort of eye-popping stuff, really.
I'm just very lucky that there was no such thing as a free hit when I played, because I did have a bit of a tendency to no ball. And you could imagine, you know, three no balls in an over, which occasionally I did incur, you know, that's a potential for even more than 37 off and over if you have to bowl nine balls. So lucky that in those days, a no ball didn't incur a free hit. Mm. And of course, Jadeja also took, I think, three wickets for about 12 or something as well, and a run
three
out.
Wickets.
So
yeah.
He's some cricketer.
Yeah. He is indeed. Talking about run outs, did you see Owen Morgan's run out? Backing up, he was. It wasn't one of those ones where the bowler knocks the bails off. He was at the non-striker's end, and there was sort of confusion. The ball actually hit his bat. He was a non-striker, hit his bat, went into the offside. The striker called him through, then said no. So Morgan was sent back. So he was run out without facing a ball. He's not had a great series so far, and nor has his team either. The Kolkata Knight Riders, they have struggled. They're one win from five matches so far, and Morgan has barely got a run. He's had four single figure scores. He walked off with a rather rueful smile. It's funny how he manages to sort of keep it all in, doesn't he? You never quite know what he's thinking, but he must. I mean, sometimes when that happens, you probably go, well, you know, it's one of those things. There's nothing I can do. These things happen in cricket. But I imagine if a few people you probably played with and played against yours in your time, who might have flung a bat or two across the dressing room and caused a few dents here and there. What about the county championship, Yoz?
Well, the county championship has been interesting. Two players that I've been with last week aren't playing in the county championship at the moment, Mark Wood and Adil Rashid. I spent 2 days with each of them up in the north. Mark Wood is hoping to play this week for Durham against Derbyshire, but Adil Rashid is obviously only on largely a white ball contract, so he's not due to play for Yorkshire until May, sort of probably late May at the earliest, when the blast starts. Wood... I think Durham will really enjoy having him back. And why was I with Mark Wood and Adil Rashid? Well, those of you who follow this podcast regularly will know that I'm making a film about England winning the World Cup, and we're featuring all the players and going back to their home environments to talk to them about their upbringing and their family influences and their friends and who got them into the game in the first place and the impact that winning the World Cup had on their communities. And actually, it's just great to see, cricket and certainly club cricket as well as county cricket coming out from under a bush, you know, coming out of its hibernation, if you like. Ashington, wonderful spot, where, of course, they've got not only a World Cup winner in Mark Wood and an Ashes winner in Steve Harmison, but the Charlton brothers as well as football World Cup winners. So quite an incredible story, actually, Ashington, the way it produces top-class sportsmen. And we said we were going to talk about fast bowling a bit today. Mark Wood, who is still trying to get faster,
He's trying to get faster.
He is. I mean, he is trying to get faster. And I think it's right in saying he has bowled the fastest ball on record by an England fast bowler, 95.8 miles an hour. And he's still keen on getting quicker. I actually talked to him on his home pitch about how a fast bowler can get quicker, and this is what he said.
Aim to be in a straight line as fast as you can. So head towards the target. So when you're running in, you're running nice and straight, as if you put a piece of string from the off stump all the way down to your run up. You follow that piece of string in, your head goes towards off stump and everything else. So anything that goes offline, whether it's your arm coming out here or out here, there has to be a counter movement. So if you go there, this then has to counter, so that everything you can keep is a straight line, as simple as possible, to get the ball from A to B, the faster you will be.
The other thing is, how do you get faster? Simple ways of, for say a 16 year old, how do they get faster?
Two things. One, you need to make your ball and base a touch wider. The more narrow you are, the harder it is to get that momentum over. So you want a little bit of a wider base, a braced front leg if you can.
So the back leg first.
Yep.
So back leg,
you want it sort of, it doesn't matter if it's in this position, the back leg doesn't matter, but what you want is that stiff contact. You drive that leg as far as you can into this position. If you're shorter, you've got no base to then go over, so you want it as wide as you can, so that nice long base, then you're going to drive this back leg and back hip as fast as you can. So if you've got a little hurdle or anything there, you put it between your legs, practice jumping over as you land, come over as long as you can and drive that leg through towards the batsman. That'll give you an extra yard of pace.
So he's using little techniques to improve his game. He's incredibly committed. He's down at his club every night or every day to practice both his batting and his bowling, just having a little bit of time off before he comes back into county cricket. And actually, you know, it's just interesting, standing next to the pitch when he's almost going through the motions, really, bowling at kind of three-quarter pace. And the velocity of his whole body you know, like a catapult, fizzing the ball down is wonderful to watch. It really is a machine that the way he glides to the wicket and then has this, as he was talking, a braced front leg and then, you know, pivots over the top of it, and this whiplash of his action fizzes the ball down. It's some sight to watch. England will be hoping that he can really keep fit. And he strapped his ankle every morning before practice to make sure that that ankle, which has had three operations, is solid and doesn't get injured again. He's sort of praying that he can have two or three more years at the top level, bowling at that sort of velocity. But God, it doesn't half take it out of you. I mean, you know, every day as a fast bowler, something hurts. So it does require, you know, a lot of commitment and almost a lot of bloody-mindedness in a way to have a career as a fast bowler.
The Championship so far, though, it's not exactly been dominated by fast bowlers. I mean, there aren't that many around. I mean, this is one of your points, isn't it? I mean, you think about when you were playing, and there were a lot of fast bowlers in county cricket, mainly because there were a lot of overseas players playing in county cricket. The top overseas bowlers were all there, so there was that sort of real focus, and you know, there was that feeling, wasn't there? Oh, when are we playing at Southampton? Oh, is my hamstring just a bit tight? I'm not sure I'll be able to play in that game or whatever. Everyone got the fixes at the start of the season and worked out whether, you know, the top fast bowlers would be playing against them. Ollie Robinson he's leading a wicket taker in terms of the quick bowlers so far. I mean, he is someone who we might well see this summer. And then there's Ollie Stone, who's picked up 11 wickets so far. He took 6 wickets in Warwickshire's win against Essex, which was just a really notable victory as well, wasn't it? For two reasons. A, that it was quite a comfortable win in the end in terms of, you know, 7 wickets. I know it was quite late on the final day, but the first time that Essex have lost in 22 matches, and a fine 100 by Rob Yates, who's a 21-year-old Birmingham University student who Alistair Cook has talked very highly of in the past. You know, he said, I remember speaking to him, you know, who have you seen around and about that's caught your eye? And Yates was one of those. So that there are players who are, you know, shining so far in the Championship. And what's great as well is the fact that it hasn't rained or barely rained. When will it ever rain again, Yoz? It's supposed to be April showers, isn't it? It's supposed to be, oh, what's the point of playing cricket in April? Waste of time. You know, the Championship's been pushed to the extremities of the season. But one thing, I don't know what it is, whether it's just a freak or whether it's climate change or whatever, one thing that seems to have happened is that, well, we had that very dry spring last year. We're having a very dry spring this year. And, of course, September is normally quite a good month for playing cricket. We don't tend to get, I mean, the nights are drawing in, the light's an issue, but we don't tend to get a huge amount of rain. And actually, think about the main cricketing months, don't you? June, July, August. Well, you know, we've had some really frustrating times of just, you know, sitting there watching the rain fall. You think of some of the test matches last summer that were hampered by rain. So, you know, I don't know, it's an interesting one, isn't it, about when the game should be played, what sort of cricket should be played at a particular time. And one thing people might say, of course, is in terms of spectating, it's nicer to watch in July and August because, you know, it's warmer. I mean, although and people can't watch at the moment, but all, you know, it has been cold. The sun's been out and it's been dry. But there's been at times there's been a sort of biting sort of northeasterly or northerly wind. But you know, we have had a lot of cricket so far. You know, basically, we've had, you know, 3 rounds of matches without a great deal of interruptions. Mm.
And players, some batsmen, with 500 runs or more in those 3 games as well. Yeah, I mean, you talk about bowlers. It's funny, actually, because I watching some of the streams of games, I just see generally seamers bowling with the wicketkeeper standing up to the stumps. That seems to be the general trend, and it has been that for, you know, a few years now, with the likes of Darren Stevens and, you know, other seam bowlers who are only bowling between 75 and 80 miles an hour, so they can afford to have the keeper stood up to the stumps. I suppose that is partly the nature of early season pitches in past years, which have helped the seam bowler, the Tim Murtas of this world, get lots of early season wickets. They haven't had quite as much success this year because the pitches have been a little bit drier. But it is a contrast to, you know, say when I played, when, I mean, you never saw a wicketkeeper stood up to the stumps in the first couple of months of the season, really, unless it was a spinner bowling, of course. It was more the case of the keeper was just stood outside the 30-yard circle. In the case of someone like Alan Donald, I did actually come into bat at Edgbaston, and the keeper and slips were outside the 30-yard circle. They were so far back. You know, it is a contrast of the way the game was sort of 25, 30 years ago. I wonder if it's to do with a combination of things, really. Batsmen who are sort of reared on white ball, one-day type cricket, therefore their footwork isn't great, non-existent in some cases, and therefore the little nagging military medium seamer with a very shiny Duke ball with a big seam can cause more problems than a quick bowler where footwork isn't quite as important. And I suppose just the sort of general nature of bowling. I mean, England tends to produce those sort of military medium seam bowlers more, doesn't it? In club cricket, if you go around the clubs scene most weekends, you'll see guys of sort of 75 miles an hour taking a lot of wickets. I'm thinking Patterson from Yorkshire, that type of bowler, for instance. There's a lot of those around, and they're up in the wicket-taking table this year as well. Ryan Higgins of Gloucester, Mohammed Abbas, we've talked about a fair bit, Hannan Dolby from Warwickshire. They're all that type of bowler, aren't they? And, you know, great that Gloucester, by the way, have done so well so far, 2 wins out of 3, and then, as we said, sort of staving off defeat in that last match as well, keeping the Hampshire bowlers at bay. Can Gloucester do it? Can Gloucester win the championship this year for the first time in their history? Well, I just worry about their bowling stocks, because in the end, I think the reason why Essex have been so successful is, yeah, they've made enough runs. They've got the Cooks and the Tom Wesleys and so on, you know, and Dan Lawrence and people making runs, but they've just got such a good bowling attack, centred around Jamie Porter and Simon Harmer. And that's where, do you think Gloucester might just fall down because they haven't got a penetrative enough bowling attack?
Well, yeah, penetrative possibly. They've got bowling resources, and they can shuffle their pack a bit. I mean, Dan Worrell, for example, came into this match, and David Payne dropped out of the side. I actually think their batting is a bit more vulnerable than their bowling. I think their bowling is steady. Their batting is prone to collapse. But I mean, they showed steely determination to thwart Hampshire. I mean, it wasn't in a way it was a grim defensive performance. I mean, they batted. I mean, Hampshire were in the field for 229.1 overs, you know, without a break. I say without a break. I mean, they obviously had, you know, tea breaks and dinner breaks and overnight. But from the time that they were all out, because they enforced the follow-on, Gloucestershire got to 150, and they did one run to avoid being asked to follow on. It was a really tense situation. I was watching it on the stream, and then Vince took a catch at the second attempt at slip, and an attacking shot and a cut shot that was just a bit too close to cut, and it was taken at slip. And so suddenly the game changed, and Hampshire felt compelled to make Gloucestershire follow on, because that was the only way, really, that they were going to win the game. You felt that they would have run out of time. The pitch was quite slow. I mean, that's the other thing as well, Jules. We've slow pitches, don't we? And we've had dry weather, but generally speaking, at this stage of the season, the pitches are a bit slow, and that doesn't really encourage fast bowling. If you want to take up fast bowling, as you know, in Australia, generally the pitches encourage you, don't you? Whereas here, that they don't. Anyway, you know, back to Gloucestershire, and they just fought it out. They had that 10th wicket stand on the last day between Dom Goodman, who's a novice. He's a talented young cricketer, just come into the side, and Josh Shaw, who they got from Yorkshire, and they resisted for sort of close on 20 overs. And it must have been awful for Hampshire, who played a lot of good cricket in the game, sort of made all the running. And actually, you look at potential county champions, and you'd have to look at, you know, Hampshire might be in there with a shout. I don't think Gloucestershire. I think they just had a very good start to the season. But Hampshire, they do look to have quite a good all-round side. And their bowling attack, it does have options. It's got a left arm. It's got Mohammed Abbas. And it's got a couple of spinners as well in Crane and Dawson. But the pitch was just a bit too slow, really, for them. They did pick up wickets. They did work away. But, ultimately, they took 19 wickets in the match. They couldn't take 20 wickets in those 230 overs they were out in the field. So I'd say no to Gloucestershire, although they have made a great start to this season. Somerset won twice as well. They'll be coming up on the rails, and Hampshire look pretty solid as well. So I think those look like the options in that division, although it is very early days, isn't it? And there's so much cricket to play yet, and who knows, we might get all this rain that we haven't had so far. When we pose the question, when will it rain again? Of course, we don't particularly want it to, but it does seem so unusual. Everything's so dry out there, and it's April. It just seems really weird. Normally, I have April showers, and you know, we've got the umbrellas up and Macintoshes on, and it's horrible weather. But long may it continue.
Hampshire, interesting. They took a bit more care, perhaps, or they were a little bit more forward thinking. Mm. In their bowling resources by signing up Mohammed Abbas and also Carl Abbott, who obviously has played for them for a couple of years, in advance of one or two of these sort of tours being added. And I mean, COVID has obviously thrown everybody's lives into total disarray, and not least the directors of cricket of the various counties trying to work out who to appoint as their overseas players, because tours of different countries have suddenly been added to make up for things that have been missed over years gone by. But the Hampshire, thinking ahead, managed to get Mohammed Abbas, who's not involved with the Pakistan Test team, which seems extraordinary, actually, but he's not playing in the Pakistan Test team, playing against Zimbabwe at the moment. And therefore, you know, that's been a lucky thing for Hampshire with Carl Abbott at the other end. Will they win the championship? Well, do you know when Hampshire last won the championship?
Go on.
1973, under Richard Gilliatt. The leading run scorer for them was Gordon Greenidge that year. And they came close in 1985. Do you know who stopped them?
You, Yoz. I bet it's you.
It was me. Kind of.
Go on, tell us the story.
Well, it was a similar story to the Gloucestershire-Hampshire game the other day. Middlesex were playing Hampshire at Dean Park, Bournemouth, which is sadly no more as a county venue. Very flat pitch. And we were batting last, needing about, 300 to win. And we collapsed to 80 for 8 by tee on the last day. So Hampshire had 2 hours to get the last two wickets and polish off victory. But somehow I managed to stay in with, I was number 10, and I managed to stay in with Jamie Sykes. We had Malcolm Marshall bowling at one end, firing them down. Luckily, as I say, it was a bit of a feather bed, so the ball wasn't bouncing much, but he tried his best. And we had an assortment of people like Cardigan Connor and Rajesh Maru and others bowling at the other end. And we managed to hold out for a draw, stayed in till the end of play. Well, that was in midsummer, and Middlesex finished up winning the championship in that year, 1985, to Hampshire, who was second, by 5 points. So if Hampshire had won that game, they would, in the end, have ended up with more points than Middlesex. And so Mark Nicholas, who was captain of Hampshire at the time, always blames me for foiling Hampshire's attempt to win the championship for the first time since 1973, and they haven't done it since. So it's nearly 40 years since they did that. So it'd be an amazing achievement. Well, more than 40 years, isn't it? Nearly 50 years, in fact.
Yeah. Close on 50 years. He blames you, Yoz. You were just doing your job, weren't you? As a lower order player. And so you're suggesting that Dom Goodman and Josh Shaw, you know, sort of history is going to repeat itself. You know, that 20 overs or whatever it was close on they batted for on the final day might sort of end up thwarting Hampshire. Well, it might. Who knows? But Hampshire top of that, top of one of the groups with 58 points. Gloucestershire second on 55. I notice in the Warwickshire Worcestershire Essex group. That excellent game between Warwickshire and Essex, finishing with a win for Warwickshire at top of that group. Bottom of the group, but it is quite tight. Bottom of that group are Nottinghamshire, but Haseeb Hameed. It feels almost at last, doesn't it? 200s in the match, batting for 635 balls. We sort of knew he had it in him. I mean, that baby boycott tag that he was given before he made his test debut in Nagpur. It came to the fore, didn't it? And they were looking to bat out the game. But that was the most anyone has batted in a championship match, definitely since 1997 when they started doing ball-by-ball records. I saw an Andrew Sampson tweet last night saying it's almost certain that someone's batted longer in the past than Hamid. But, I mean, the stats going around, you know, he's batted longer than anybody in a county championship match. But that isn't necessarily the case. But what you can say is, you know, fantastic effort from him. And you have that feeling, don't you, in the game. Anyone who saw him play in Nagpur, saw him play on that Indian tour, and actually saw him play in Mohali as well. He played a superb innings in Mohali with a broken finger, and then he had to leave the tour after that because there was just too much damage and they couldn't risk him playing, you know, especially if he was fielding. But anyone who saw him play thought that, you know, this guy has got the technique, he has got the temperament to play Test cricket. There have been doubts about his ability against the short ball, and you know, as Geoffrey was saying in the Virtual Cricket Club actually a couple of weeks ago, you know, if you're struggling against the short ball, you will get found out eventually in Test cricket. But anyone who saw him thought this guy's going to go on and play 80 Test matches or whatever for England, and it just hasn't happened. His career has just sort of gone off a cliff. You know, really low averages, averaged 30, you know, a bit better last season, averaged 38, but you know, 200s in the match. I suppose it's watch this space from here, isn't it? I mean, it's only the first stepping stone, really. You have to, you know, it's very good, excellent, 200s in the match, batting a long time, but it's sort of putting all those innings together now, I suppose, and trying to, you know, really sort of build your portfolio, build your CV up to say, yeah, I really am back.
Oh, it's great to see, and it brings to mind that sort of terrible cliche about London buses, doesn't it? That he hadn't scored on many runs for a long time, and then suddenly 200 in the same game. Good footwork is one thing. You know, I mentioned before that the lack of footwork you see in a lot of players now, and he's certainly not one of those. He is someone who does, you know, take a proper stride to the ball. And actually, one of the things I worried about him a little bit was that at times he got so close to the ball, almost sort of sniffing it, that he would get hit on the hands. And sure enough, he did, actually, and had a broken finger, you know, which kind of caused him quite a lot of problems. So maybe he's adapted that a bit. Because if you play too low as an opening batsman, certainly in Test cricket, you are going to get hit on the fingers quite a lot. So that's one area that maybe he can work on. Now, this is maybe a non sequitur, but Jonathan Agnew, who I mentioned at the start, we're featuring on this programme today, and he wasn't keen on batting. In fact, in the quiz that we did with him in the Virtual Cricket Club last week, one of the questions was, why did you bat outside leg stump against Wayne Daniel at Lord's? And his correct answer was, I felt I owed it to my side to be fit to bowl. So he took guard outside leg stump and didn't last very long. But the whole thing about fast bowlers is that you do want to try and stay fit to bowl, obviously, because fast bowling can be quite a short career. We've already seen Mark Wood have a number of injuries that have held him back. I mean, Jimmy Anderson remarkably has managed to overcome lots of injuries in his case, certainly more recently, and Stuart Broad another one as well. They've had a long career, partly, I suppose, looked after by the ECB, not playing too much one-day cricket, and you know, very much sort of protected, kept into cotton wool, if you like, so they're able to bowl fast into their mid and late 30s. Agnew wasn't one of those. He was often on the physio's table, though I think that was possibly just for having a rest as much as any treatment required.
He did take 666 first-class wickets.
Yeah, no, and he did. And he was a superb bowler that I really looked up to. I mean, he was built, you know, like a stick insect, but he did actually generate good pace and he swung the ball as well. He was very consistent. So, you know, he was a fine bowler. And the only thing I'd say about having a fast bowling career is you do need to have something to back you up, because that career could end at any moment. Mm. So to start thinking in your 30s about what else you can do is quite important. And that's something Jonathan really very much did. He did all sorts of odd jobs in the winters. So we just asked him in the Virtual Cricket Club how it was that he started out in radio.
It was about 1987, wasn't it, I think, when because we had to get jobs. There weren't 12-month contracts for county cricketers, so you had to get work. And I had done all sorts of strange things. I'd driven a lorry delivering asbestos, that I slightly regret these days. made windows in a window factory. I mean, you know, all sorts of things, because you could only get a 6-month job. No one's going to take you on for longer because they knew that you'd be gone in April. So it was a 6-month job. And then John Rawling, who was the sports producer at Radio Leicester, came up to me one September, I suppose. So what are you doing? I said, I've got nothing. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so he said, well, come and work for us. Come work for Radio Leicester. He said, you won't get paid anything, but I think you'll enjoy it. I think you might be quite good at it. Come and give it a go. So that was how it started. I started off doing the early morning shift. So up at, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever, doing the sports shifts. That's where I met Emma, because she was doing the news. And there were so many mistakes. I mean, local radio, you burn off all your mistakes there, don't you? I mean, and you quickly progress. That's the thing, because local radio in those days.
You'd hope you burn them all off, Angus.
Well, you don't always burn them off. But John very quickly went to London, and then I'm suddenly doing not just the early shifts, but I'm doing the Saturday afternoon programme, playing records. You know, some at the wrong speed in those days. You're supposed to play at 45, they come in at 33 and a third, and just horrendous mistakes. But I loved radio, and I really got the bug. So for those 2 or 3 years, those winters, Radio Leicester let me do it every winter. And the football managers, I loved David Pleat, Brian Hamilton. They were just so good to me at Leicester, because I didn't know anything about football at all. And of course, like any local radio station, the world revolves around its local football club. And they were brilliant. I'd sit down with David Pleat, who had come under a bit of a shadow from Tottenham Hotspur, I think, or Luton or somewhere. Anyway, a bit of a shadow. Anyway, he was there, and he was so nice and so kind. And Brian too, Brian Hamilton, who I interviewed, funnily enough, I think he became the Antiguan coach or something. And so I interviewed him when we were last in Antigua. Lovely Irishman.
Who yeah, just very nice man.
And they would say, how long have you got? I said, well, I need 5 minutes, really. Oh, okay, they'll just talk. And they were fantastic. Both loved their cricket, and both gave me a hand. But I think you know, and you two will know too, what essentially of a type of broadcaster you are. Are you a radio person or are you a television person? Because they are very different. And, I know absolutely unequivocally I'm a radio person. I don't feel comfortable doing live television. It doesn't.
Why is that? What is it about live television?
I'm not sure. I think it's a bit self-conscious, I think. You know, whereas radio, you're just hidden away, aren't you? And, you know, no one can see you. So I prefer working like that. You can be more yourself. The camera's always on you, isn't it? And I mean, I think the camera flatters some people, and it doesn't necessarily flatter some other people. I have got a very large nose, and it sort of seems to cast an enormous shadow across the presenter of television when I'm on it. I'm just happy on the radio. You know, you're anonymous. I would hate to live a television person's life where, you're just recognised all the time. I mean, that must be, really tricky. So radio it is for me. I'm at home on the radio. You can, I find I can be myself on the radio, where not perhaps so much on the telly. So that's,
Do you find that people recognise your voice?
Oh yeah,
more than your face. I mean, when they hear you talking, they go, "Oh, I recognise your voice."
It's extraordinary. I mean, you know, obviously I don't live in London, so I do. I get cabs here and there, and taxi drivers are extraordinary because someone will get it straight away. I'll say, "Lords, Angus, oh mate, great to talk to you. Yeah, I'll be tuned in later." And others will be. You can see them sitting there, and they'll be talking. And you can see them, and you know what they're thinking: "Who the hell is this?" And sort of, and then you get to the end of the journey, you know, they're like, "Oh, please, for God's sake, put me out of my misery, you know. Who are you? I've been, I know that voice." And you tell, "Oh, of course, mate, you know, of course, oh, crikey, yeah, love the cricket." And it's really strange moments where you sort of have to behave yourself, really. I mean, you know, supermarket queues have been a bit stressful recently, haven't they? And I remember an incident about a few months ago where I just got a bit cross with what was going on. There was a bit of a shambles going on the front. You know, come on, you know. And hold it, yeah, keep your hair on, Aggers, you know. You'll be right, oh, God, you know, someone's
got it. Late for that. Yeah,
exactly. Well, indeed. So, you know, but that goes with the territory, doesn't it? But I to get that first thing, I mean, I remember my first broadcast for BBC sort of serious radio, not underplaying Radio Leicester, but Peter Baxter left. I was on the 91 Ashes tour, And we were in Ballarat, I think, either Ballarat or Bendigo. And he had gone, and CMJ, bless him, we always turned up late, wasn't going to do one of those games. So he was rocking up for the Melbourne Test of Boxing Day. So I was left in charge of covering the England tour, not just the Today newspaper, who I was writing for, but also for BBC. And I remember, because I was so self-conscious about my voice, and I insisted, to the surprise of the locals, on the line being put into the groundsman's shed. So I knew no one would be in there. And so the groundsman, geez, Matt, what are you doing in here? You know, and I said, well, I'm BBC, and you know, it's obviously got a view from here, the scoreboard or something. But it's purely because I was so self-conscious of not doing these reports for the first time in front of all the hacks who I was up in competition with anyway, working with Today. I was up against the Sun and the Star and the Mirror, all these bloke Mail, Express. Now, the only problem was that the groundsman had this bloody great Alsatian dog that was a real brute of a thing. And it took a complete dislike to me. And so every time I went into the groundsman's shed to go do my report on the hour it was, this thing would just go berserk. You could hear it sort of salivating at the door and trying to break into the shed to come and devour me or something. So that pretty quickly taught me, you just got to, and you've done it many, many times, both of you, yeah, you just got to hide your inhibitions, haven't you? And it's a horrible thing broadcasting in a silent press box.
It's funny, actually, with Jonathan now, because you almost forget that he played first-class cricket. You almost forget that he played, three Test matches for England, three one-day internationals, and probably in another era, I don't know, he might have played a bit more. There were quite a few bowlers around at the time, and you know, sometimes it's about whether your face fits at the right time. And you know, you think of someone like, Neil Mallander got a Test match, didn't he? I know Angus did get a Test match, but you know, lots of people got Test matches, and also I thought that sense in which there was a bit of a conveyor belt as well. You got picked for a few games, and then you got jettisoned, and that wasn't just bowlers; it was batsmen as well. But I mean, someone who did make a very successful career as a quick bowler is coming in the Virtual Cricket Club this week.
Yeah, Darren Goff, yes, the Dazzler, as he was well known. And he started out, actually, as not a quick bowler. Funnily enough, a bit like Mark Wood, because Mark Wood, when he was 17 or 18, he says, was only a sort of medium-ish pace, really. And he was more
That's
of a
right.
batsman
and he bat-
to start
batsman,
with.
Batsman, yeah.
But he then, you know, found a way of bowling quicker. And Goffey was the same. There's an interesting story, actually, about Goffey and when he was playing for Yorkshire. And Richie Richardson was the overseas player. And they were bowling against Hampshire. Hampshire keeps cropping up in this episode, doesn't it? And he couldn't get the last few batsmen out. And he was bowling his sort of, you know, 82 miles an hour stuff. And Sean Udall was one who was knocking him around a bit. And Richie Richardson went down the pitch from first slip and said to Goffey, come on, man, you know, let him have it, man. You know, really let him have it. And so Goffey stepped it up a bit and started to bowl proper quick stuff. And from then on, he was able to generate 90 mile an hour deliveries and did become a genuine quick bowler, and that changed his career. Just that sort of one word from Richie, really, that one a little bit of advice, and he converted from someone who was probably just one of a number of fast medium bowlers to someone who was a real spearhead for quite a long time. And we've got him in the Virtual Cricket Club this Wednesday. It's a later start than normal because he does his Talk Sport show from 4 till 7. Then he's got to get home. So we're starting at 9 o'clock this Wednesday night in the Virtual Cricket Club. Darren Goff, exclusively for us to hear his opinions. And he's always quite forthright.
Yep.
So you can join us by going to worldsbestcricketclub.com. That's worldsbestcricketclub.com. It's £6 a month to join, but the money goes to the Professional Cricketers Trust, the charity that supports cricketers who've fallen on hard times, a few fast bowlers amongst them, no doubt. And it's £6 a month, as I say, but that guarantees four live events. And we have Paul Collingwood in the Virtual Cricket Club the week after. So some good, a good couple of guests coming up.
Yeah, and will Goffey finish by midnight? I mean, as you say, he's normally got quite a lot of opinions and quite a lot to say. So you as the sort of like the host, Yozza, I think you need to get us all in our beds reasonably early because do we want to?
Well, it's you I worry about. You're the one who always wants to go off early, don't you? Because you've got to go and read your wife a nighttime story, a bedtime story,
or my daughter a bedtime story, or whatever, or just spend some time with the family, or. or watching Unforgotten, catching up on Unforgotten on Netflix, those sorts of things. Anyway, or Walk the Dog as well. So, you know, there are lots of things to do. But anyway, so, yeah, that's your task, Yoz, usher Goffey into...
Keep it short and sweet.
Usher Goffey into a, you know, maximum 10:30 finish on Wednesday night.
Yeah, okay, I will. And by the way, I said we got Paul Collingwood the week after. Did you see he played against Woody in the North Eastern Premier League at the weekend? Collingwood playing for Shotley Bridge, Woody playing for Ashington. Woody bowled a few overs. I don't think he got any wickets. He didn't get. He was actually supposed to be playing as a batsman, batted at number three. But when he found out Collingwood was playing, he said, right, I'm going to have a bowl as well. But Collingwood had the last laugh. He got 26 not out and saw his team to victory.
It's amazing, isn't it? You play club cricket at the weekend and, it's challenging. But then suddenly there's Mark Wood, one of the fastest bowlers in the world, charging in at you. Talk about pulling those hamstrings earlier on when you're facing Malcolm Marshall. You'd be tempted to do that, wouldn't you, as a club cricketer? But, I mean, if he said he wasn't going to bowl, then you think, OK, fair enough. Then suddenly you see him at the end of his elongated run-up now, because, of course, he's lengthened it. Anyway, it's best these days to watch it all from the sidelines rather than be out there.
Well, I don't know, you know. The thing is, I mean, you want to experience it, though, don't you? Mm. I mean, don't you want to, even if you get a first bowler, I was there sort of moment, isn't it? I faced Mark Wood in a club match. Yeah. I mean, you know, the protection's pretty good these days. He's not going to try and bounce you out unless
you face Goffey, actually.
Sledge him first.
I faced Goffey. Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah. In the nets at Lords.
And it's pretty serious stuff, isn't it? Did you survive?
I did, actually, yeah. But, I mean, you know, I didn't hit many. He was sort of nipping them back onto my thigh pad. It was some sort of sponsors event, and he wasn't really rushing in. Dominic Cork was there as well. He bowled me a bouncer, of course. Well, that's inevitable, isn't it, with Cork? I mean, I did have a helmet on, but he couldn't resist the temptation to bowl me a bouncer. But Goffey pitched it up and moved it around. I didn't hit many. But you're right.
God, I so wish I could have had a go at you when I was in my pomp. I would have given you lots around your ear holes. Yeah. Oh, I'd have really loved that.
Well, persecuting people who are not as good as you, Yoz, that's nice, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you know, if you've got that armoury of an 84-mile-an-hour bouncer, use it whenever you can and shut people up.
Talking about shutting people up, it's time to shut up you, Yoz. Great. Right, join us on Wednesday in the Virtual Cricket Club. But for this podcast, that's it for now. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.